Yeah, so I had something nice happen the other day.
Oh.
Yeah.
Max Change.
A novice in the order who, they were saying that they'd listened to our first two episodes.
Yeah.
And they found them interesting and so on. But they really didn't know anything about Aleister Crowley or occultism or Thelema or magic or any of that stuff because they hadn't come from that background.
Mm.
They'd come to Magia because they were simply looking for self-realization or spirituality or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. For me, that seemed like a big deal.
Yeah.
Because I've always felt like we, back in the Baptist Head days, were always trying to re-establish a particular view of magic, that it belonged up there with the other traditions.
Mm.
You know, like Buddhism or Taoism or Advaita or whatever.
Yeah.
So that felt significant for me.
Nice.
Because, of course, there are still people today who would deny that magic has anything to do with reality.
Yeah. Well, with awakening, with enlightenment, that kind of stuff.
Well, I meant that, but that's reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that may not be clear to everybody.
No. And then, of course, if you pay attention, any tradition, any serious wisdom tradition, is inseparable from magical experiences and magical practices.
Mm.
It's only where those traditions, particularly from the East, have been imported into the West, that they've been sanitized of those elements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, it made me think that perhaps for this episode, maybe we could cover a brief introduction to Aleister Crowley.
Wow.
And Thelema. Yeah. Because he might seem at first blush that he's, impenetrable, inaccessible, that kind of a thing.
Mm.
There seems to be a lot of confusion online about what it is that he taught. But I think with, just one book, one text, which you can actually get for free online, right, and relying on your own reading comprehension, it's actually pretty straightforward and pretty simple.
Wow. I get the feeling you're going to be taking this really back to absolute basics somehow.
The thing about Crowley's work is that it's very, very simple.
Okay.
Right? Now, Crowley's life fit the pattern of many other individuals that have come before.
Yeah.
Right, for thousands of years in many different cultures around the world. But basically, you have someone who is chosen to speak on behalf of the divine,
mm-hmm.
usually after a great deal of self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
And that looks like a certain kind of practice, right? A certain kind of spiritual practice, that kind of a thing. A certain kind of devotion, quality of devotion. And they get chosen to bring to their community a divine law that's either shown to them or given to them by the divine,
yeah.
often a goddess. And their one job is not to pervert or destroy or manipulate or change what they are trusted to transmit, based on personal preference and that kind of a thing. That's their one job. They then have the privilege of determining how what has been delivered might be cultivated into practice, what ordeals might be set for people who wish to belong to a lineage that explicitly adheres to the law that's been delivered. But other than that, it's a case of the law being given to the people and then the people deciding whether or not they abide by that law.
Right.
So it's as simple as that. So Crowley was given a book, or rather a book was dictated to him in 1904 in Cairo. It's only three short chapters. The content of the book itself contains everything that I've just said. And he was tasked with giving people a copy of this book. That was to be their introduction to this law.
Uh-huh.
Right. So what's expected is that a newcomer, someone who has no idea about Aleister Crowley or Thelema or magic or occultism or any of that stuff, their introduction should be the text itself. And then it's up to the person reading the book whether they adhere to that law or not.
Yeah.
Now, Crowley elaborated on that with a very short comment at the end of the book.
Okay.
To the effect that anyone who wishes to understand the law, in addition to them approaching it themselves, right, it should be understood through Aleister Crowley's works alone. And anyone who discusses the content of the book should be considered a centre of pestilence. That's the famous phrase.
Yeah.
From in the comment. And then it even says, you should burn your copy of the book after first reading. You'd be a fool not to. Right. So again, we're back to this idea of not requiring gatekeepers. Right. We don't need mass market paperback introductions to Thelema. You could save yourself some money if you're interested in understanding Crowley just by reading the Book of the Law.
And if he's saying that you should burn your copy after first reading, there's...
Yeah.
presumably not a lot to remember.
Not really. No, it is pretty simple. Right. It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
Like, I won't even be quoting scripture. Mm-hmm. Because that's a kind of an annoying thing to do, isn't it? People quote scripture at you. I won't be offering an interpretation. I'm not, strictly speaking, discussing the contents of the book in the sense of acting like a gatekeeper. Uh-huh. I'm just going to tell you what the words say. It's just there. It's very simple, right? So, the three short chapters, the first chapter, the very first line, uh-huh. or rather the very first, you know, few lines, right? It's saying, here's a description, here's a revelation about the nature of heaven, about the nature of human beings, that every man and every woman is a star in the body of a goddess called Nuit, which is the goddess of infinite space mm-hmm. and the infinite stars thereof. Right. So it's the unveiling of the company of heaven. So that's a way of saying human beings, in their innermost sense, are like stars in the night sky, each one unique in perspective. Right, but having a unique perspective means it's really one identity. And in the second chapter of the Book of the Law, it's in the voice of that identity. It's another god called Hadit. Mm-hmm. And it's understood it's the conjunction of Hadit and Nuit that gives rise to this world, the god of this world being Ra-Harkuit, which is the voice of the third chapter.
Right.
So there's an idea of God or the divine being our fundamental nature, but it's best to understand that divinity as a multiplicity of viewpoints. So this is a very particular view of what God means, or what the divine means. Mm. Yeah, so it's the voice of heaven, it's the voice of God, it's the voice of the divine. We are that divinity. It's one, but it's understood as a multiplicity.
Yeah.
So that's what it starts with. That's how it starts.
Yeah.
And a law is given. Now, the giving of divine law isn't a command that these laws must be followed. Rather, it's the giving of the law so human beings can then decide whether or not they abide by it, given a description of what the consequences are if that law is broken. Mm-hmm. It's like the law of physics, or laws of physics or something like that, rather than law as it's generally understood. Right? The dire consequences that might follow from breaking the law isn't a result of an artificially created morality, right, that's used to cohere a society together. It's basically, this is how reality is. If you do X, then Y will follow, and it sucks. It's bad if you do that.
Yeah.
Instead, you should do this.
Are laws of physics like that?
Well, laws of physics are, you know, if a ball will roll downhill with no judgment made, it's just going to do that. It's how it is. If you drop your ball, it's going to roll down the hill.
Yeah.
So if you don't want it to roll down the hill, don't drop your ball.
Okay.
So the virtue of having someone who can speak on behalf of the divine is that you will be told and shown how reality is.
Yeah.
And your place in it, then you have the choice of what you can expect to happen if you behave a certain way. Mm-hmm. Right? Usually there's two choices, you know, two directions to move in. But it's not, you're not forbidden from breaking the law, but you were told what the consequences would be. Yeah, so the virtue is that you get to see the nature of things and perhaps participate in the nature of things in a more conscious fashion than you might have done before, with full comprehension in terms of what it is that you're doing. But as it says in the Book of the Law, you can give this book to everyone that you meet, and you should do that. And it doesn't matter whether they adhere to it or not.
Yeah.
You don't have to concern yourself with that. That's not the role of a prophet. It's not the role of the divine.
Yeah.
You might say, if someone was religious in the sense that they follow this law, it's not the role of the religious to make sure people follow the law.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So there's a massive difference between how we normally think of divine law and what its nature actually is.
Yeah. Because if, as you're saying, it's reality, then nobody can be reality, can they? They're not the one who make the consequences of breaking the law, are they? It's reality itself.
Yeah, it's like in one of our previous episodes where we talked about the fact that a certain degree of realization, you come to see that there is no line in the sand, meaning there is no human-made institution of morality required to be imposed upon the world and other people, because there is already a divine law.
Yeah.
Right? So when the concern with morality drops away, it's not because you become amoral or you're some kind of moral relativist. It's because you become a moral absolutist in the real sense, in a real sense. So divine law is nothing other than the nature of the divine itself. So the free expression of that nature is the same thing as demonstration of the law.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you don't have to concern yourself with that or try and make up for it, because it's not absent in the first place,
yeah,
the way that it appears to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's like the opposite of how we normally think about morality, and particularly religious institutions as a way of enforcing morality.
Mm.
Okay, so what is the law?
Do what thou wilt.
Yeah, so in the book, it's the famous line, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law."
Mm.
So there's not much to it. Do what thou wilt. That's the whole of it. There isn't anything else.
Right.
Do what thou wilt. But what does that mean?
Yeah.
Now, I've seen online many kinds of interesting philosophical debates about what "do what thou wilt" means. Now Crowley would refer to "do what thou wilt" as the true will. Doesn't actually say that in the text, but he referred to it that way because he wanted to make a clear distinction between what's meant by "do what thou wilt" and what people might think hearing that phrase. Right. So sometimes people think it means "do what you want."
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Indulge your preferences.
Yeah. Almost kind of saying from that perspective that there is no law. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Well, there isn't a law. It's just do what you want.
Yes. So he wanted to make this clear. So there's the true will, right, which is the same thing as "do what thou wilt," which implies, doesn't it, that there's something that might look like a false will. And we just talked about doing what you want might be an example of that.
Mm.
But there's a reason why we need that distinction. If we separate out the idea of "do what thou wilt" from its origin, right, so it was delivered from the divine through a prophet, right? Now, if we decide we're not going to believe that or have anything to do with it, right, you end up with something like a secular philosophy, something like that.
Mm.
Libertarian, perhaps, in nature.
Yeah.
Right. And then you get these, what they call thought experiments.
Yeah. A lot of conversations I've had with people about true will, they end up regarding it as, you know, something like the best version of yourself, the optimized self, you know, the thing that you're supposed to be doing. I mean, a lot of people end up talking about their career or their profession. Have they found their true will? Are they fulfilling the role in life that they're supposed to be fulfilling?
I think it's understandable why some people might think that.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I don't blame them for it. But I'll give you an example of one of these thought experiments. This is a real example from a forum that I saw.
Yeah.
So someone posited the situation that perhaps you're going into a car park to go and do your shopping and you're about to pull into an empty space. But then all of a sudden, someone else pulls in before you and steals it. So the question is, was it your true will to have that parking spot? And that the other person got in the way, you know, broke the law?
Right.
Or was it the other person's true will who stole the spot? So, and then the debate ensues. Now, I mean, just telling you this example...
Yeah.
Right. Is tedious, isn't it? Let alone the following, you know, philosophical debate.
Yeah. What is that about? That seems to be about whether things that happen in the world are supposed to happen or not.
I think it's a fundamental, the fundamental orientation of our culture versus what the book of the law is.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. The book of the law is the fundamental orientation of the ancient world and most other cultures, even in modernity, right? Although that's being undone. Our view is kind of this, I mean, just in calling it a thought experiment. Like what we're doing is rationally is we're moving variables around like we're doing an experiment, and a result will pop out at the end, which will tell us what is true or not.
Right.
Except it's not an experiment, is it? It's an imaginary exercise at best. Our first move when we hear something like the description of how the book of the law was arrived at, like where it came from, what its nature is, like we distance ourselves and take a sceptical viewpoint, don't we?
Yeah.
That's the first move. And the question is, well, it's up to each person to decide the degree to which they put faith in that assertion. But what we can do is we can see that it's sophisticated and we'll use our reason to try and understand it and take it apart and extract value from it.
Mm.
And the degree of the value we can extract from it using our secular, rational, vivisection methods, right, is the degree to which it's useful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this is a way of understanding where our culture's at. We don't know anything else other than vivisection. That's what we do. We chop things up into parts to try and discover or extract some kind of value from it.
Mm.
And we don't know how to relate to anything in any other way now. The book of the law, on the other hand, is it doesn't even ask you to believe. It just tells you what it is. Its nature is that which it describes, and the relationship you can have with it is a choice, and it describes that relationship, right? And it's up to you whether you have that relationship with it or not. But it tells you what will happen if you don't, Here we're coming back to the simple idea of what do what thou wilt means. So not even leaving the first chapter of the book, there's a divinity understood as a multiplicity of viewpoints, and that's who we are as human beings. The unveiling of the company of heaven, eternity, right? Who we really are, in addition to and outside of our lives as human beings here. And there is just one law, do what thou wilt. Now, an injunction is given in the book, and the goddess says, I will give you everything that you've ever wanted in your human life.
Mm-hmm.
I will give you greater rewards in death. Dissolution in the blissful body of the goddess, of the divine, eternal life, and so on and so forth. Right. And what's required for that, to honour your nature as a star in the body of the goddess, right, is to always be devoted to that goddess or to the divine.
Mm-hmm.
So to be aimed at the divine. She repeats a number of times, you know, you can do all the things that you've ever wanted to do, but it should always be to me.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Always in devotion to the divine, always with your eyes on the divine. So it doesn't matter what you do, as long as it's recognizing that your natural orientation as a star in the body of the goddess is union with that goddess.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very basic, very simple. If you want to do your will, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Yeah.
Right? That's the same thing as doing anything in service to the goddess, in devotion to the divine. This conception of God.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's nothing to do with getting a parking space or getting a good job or being the best version of yourself. It's not about it's not about anything. It's not about getting anything.
No.
Or becoming anything.
No, although all of that will be given.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is a very traditional understanding of this path, what it means to look to another world, to look to heaven, to look to the divine, and bring that nature here and exercise that nature in this world. It's understood that that's like renouncing the world, or that's like renouncing appearances, you know, in a material sense. But actually, you will be given all of those things, all of those things. So there's talk in the text of drugs and wine and sex and riches, spices, if you're into cooking, lots of other things of that nature. There's talk of that. You can have all of that.
Mm.
But precisely because you're not concerned with any of it, you'll have it, you can have it all. But you'll actually think to yourself, these are just playthings. It's not even... they're not even that important, because there's something better than that, and that's the ecstasy of the union with the goddess, with the divine. So you get given all of that, and you'll surpass the men of the earth, in that regard. But it'll be something that you're happy to discard.
Yeah, yeah.
See, there's a lot of language in the Book of the Law that's very similar to the language of the Bible, the King James Version, because of course that's part of our Western tradition. But there's two ideas: being raised up and being righteous. Being raised up means to be successful in the conventional sense.
Mm-hmm.
But being righteous means having this connection with the divine and being only concerned with the divine. And so riches can come and go.
Yeah.
You'll have all of it and you won't even care about it.
Yeah. And what Crowley also seems to be saying, if I'm understanding right, is that is will. That is what will is. Will is being in alignment with the divine.
Yeah. Union with the divine. Seeking union with the divine.
Yeah.
She says it over and over and over again,
gives
instructions for it. That's it. That's how you do your will. Now, how it looks in the world, it will be very particular to each unique viewpoint, each unique star. So there will be particulars unique to each person in terms of what their will might look like. Now, just to draw an analogy, right, to try and make this idea clearer, we spoke about working with the Holy Guardian Angel, didn't we, earlier in our magical careers. And there's this trajectory. Again, it's a traditional trajectory that's described in many different places. But you start off learning magic. You learn different techniques. You learn to bind spirits and compel them to do stuff. You'll do rituals to engineer synchronicities and that kind of a thing. And all of that relies on your own understanding of morality, like we talked about before. But part of that is understanding what's good for yourself. So you're going to determine what's good for yourself. So you have your best laid plans, your preferences.
Mm-hmm.
But at a certain point, you start to see that the magical results that you're getting don't abide by the facade of a causal relationship. That you can indulge for a certain amount of time doing magic, but at a certain point, you start to see that just does not explain what it is that you're experiencing anymore.
Yeah. Although I think people do get stuck there, don't they?
Oh, yes, they do.
Yeah. Because I mean, a lot of discourse around true will that you see online, often you see people saying, well, it's my true will to be like this, to have a certain personality trait or something like that. You know, this is my role. Yeah. It's my true will to be this person. But how would you ever be able to distinguish something like that from just a personality trait, from just some circumstance in your life? How would you ever know that was your true will if that's the perspective on it that you're taking? You wouldn't.
No, but actually there's a way of identifying whether you're doing your true will or not. It's very simple, which we'll get to in a bit. Mm. But when you reach that point, that threshold, you automatically decide that you wish to be aligned with the highest power that you can think of, magically speaking.
Yeah.
And this becomes the invocation of the Holy Guardian Angel, in terms of how Crowley formulated it. You can prepare yourself magically for that kind of a work, but you can't make it happen. That highest conception you have of your most profound nature will turn up when it's time, when it determines it's time. And that's the first indication that you're participating in a process with an intelligence that's beyond your own.
Mm.
Right, and then the hierarchy flips, or rather the delusion that you're at the top of the pecking order disappears. There's something greater than yourself.
Mm.
Something, however, that's intimate with your own nature. So there's a mystery there. But then you become one-pointed and concerned with only one working, which is the invocation of that Holy Guardian Angel, or that union with the divine. We're talking about the same thing in a slightly different way.
Mm.
But then the miraculous happens. You start to get material, practical, magical results that are beyond what you were capable of with your practical methods, in the sense that you get results for things that you couldn't have conceived of as being fundamentally fulfilling for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, as if there's an intelligence that knows you better than yourself and is now providing you with the things that would actually make you fulfilled as a person that you couldn't have even guessed at.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So that's this is an example. You're now one-pointed on the divine.
Yeah.
Union with the divine, that's all you care about.
Yeah.
But now you're being given all the things that you wanted before, but you don't really want them.
Yeah.
They're just playthings.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure we've talked about it before, but that sense of impossibility that you have after the experience of the angel, you know, that it just is something that you would never have believed was possible.
Yeah. Yeah, so how do you know then if you're doing your true will?
Mm-hmm.
It's not through the exercising of negative emotional states. It's not through conflict.
Mm.
Doesn't look like that.
Mm.
It looks like the joyous free expression of your own nature. Now, the difference between that, which we'll call that true will,
yeah,
right? Something you don't have to struggle with. It's your own nature. It's being expressed. But it needed bringing here and cultivating through union with the divine.
Yeah.
Right? Well, we can have what we might call a false will that's informed by the false understanding we have of our own nature. Crowley used the analogy of thinking about the true will as the orbit of a star. Every star has its own orbit. And one of the biggest problems we have as human beings is that we look at other stars and we try and mimic their orbit instead of following our own.
Mm.
So as human beings, we're full of these ideas of a false orbit and we try and pursue them. Right? In Magia, we would say these are shadows.
Mm.
These are our shadows that we have. The false understanding we have of our own nature. So the trajectory we're talking about, union with the divine, takes you through all of those and hopefully leads to the resolution of them.
Mm.
Until your false preferences, they drop away. So this process means going beyond all of the most convincing appearances that we might have about who and what we are, our identities and so on.
Mm.
And in the end, you just end up being a person.
Mm.
But that's a person, that's a human being doing their true will. Now, it may take a particular form that you might describe it as, like, spending all of your time as a counsellor helping people. So you could, from that appearance, say, oh, you know, your true will is a vocation. But that's like a partial truth.
Mm.
And if we only have the partial truth, then we end up making mistakes, like mistaking other partial truths or appearances to be the whole of the truth. If you enjoy being resentful and petty, right, you might end up thinking, well, maybe, because I do it all the time, and it comes very easily to me, that's my true will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When it isn't.
The true will, the nature of a human being, is to unite with the divine.
Yeah, so that a human being can become what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. That reminds me of something that came up on a podcast I did a while back, where I was talking about the nature of angels. And I was thinking about angels as beings that automatically execute the will of the divine. They can't do anything other. Mm. And in this podcast, I was saying, if I had the choice to become a being like that, knowing what I know, having had the experiences that I've had, then I would, without thinking about it. You know, the idea of being something that executed the will of the divine automatically, couldn't fall away from that in any shape or form. That's something that really appeals to me. And I got a bit of pushback on that from people who were quite shocked, who were quite surprised by it. They saw it as a giving up of freedom. In other words, a loss of will.
Right.
But actually, you know, what we're talking about here is that turning towards the divine, that union with the divine, is will itself.
Well, not only is it will itself, it's the beginnings of discovering will itself and what freedom actually means.
Mm.
Again, another traditional understanding, and it's an uncomfortable one that no one likes to contemplate. But human beings aren't free. Everyone's radically asleep.
Mm-hmm.
There are these images that are conjured up by great spiritual beings of the past, right? Where they've been given this description by the divine. That it's like we're blind and we're deaf and we're just walking around bumping into each other.
Yeah.
At the mercy of the strongest impression of the moment. And then we pronounce ourselves, though, free and rational.
Yeah.
You know, and that we understand who and what we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a terrible image. That is what we are.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that thing I was talking about with the angel, that automatically doing of the divine will without any obstacle or filter to that. I mean, that's not a human experience, is it?
No.
Another thing that comes to mind when you're meditating or you're contemplating, you're doing your practice and you have that experience of union with the divine. One of the things that always amuses me about it is, you know, there you are, you're completely merged with that. But after a while, you'll start to get bored.
Yeah.
Even though you're in that perfection and it's inexhaustible, it just gives of itself entirely over and over again, and you're completely lost and at one in that. Even in that, after a certain amount of time, you'll start to get bored. You'll start to think about what you're having for dinner, or your leg will start to hurt. And that's the human experience, isn't it?
Yeah. The reason it starts to get boring as well is because you haven't lost that devotion to the divine, which means that whatever it is that you encounter, no matter how profound it might be, we can think about that in symbolic terms, in terms of whether we talk about an angel or a goddess or whatever. But we can also talk about it in terms of our immediate experience, you know, awakenings, how they're described, self-realization. And I'm talking about the most profound descriptions. They are nevertheless an appearance. Right, and eventually you're going to realize you take it to be the most profound thing, and it is for a while. But after a while, you're going to realize there's still the horizon that you can't see over, and you're called to go beyond it.
Right.
So there's even more profound experiences to go through. There's something beyond even what you're experiencing now, as miraculous as it might be.
Mm.
Are you going to say yes to it or not? It's up to you.
Yeah.
Right. So this is one of the things about the nature of the divine that I wanted to bring up. When you said some people thought it was like giving up the idea of choice or freedom.
Mm.
The divine is so divine, right? It's so free, it's so ideal, that it doesn't even force its own nature upon you, even though it is your nature. Right? So again, coming back to that idea of what divine law is, you're told what the law is, but you're not told you have to follow it. You're just told what the consequences are.
Yeah.
Right? Which is your doing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is your doing. So you can say yes to your own nature, to your inheritance, if you want. That's completely up to you.
Yeah. And you see that in that experience I was talking about, where you're merged in this experience, and after a while you start to get bored, and you're allowed to get bored, aren't you? You're allowed to think about what you're going to have for dinner, even in the middle of that. There's something so beautiful in that, isn't there? Such kindness and compassion and love. In that you're allowed to fuck it up.
We have this hangover from Christianity where we think that the divine can either be beneficial or detrimental, you know, like a harsh father or something like that, and that we'll be punished. And that God might ask us to do stuff we don't want to do, like genocide a local tribe.
Right.
Or something like that. If we put aside the poison of the distorted Christianity, right, because it's not how it was intended, right, one way of understanding the nature of the divine is that the outcome from expressing your true will, which we can define as self-sacrifice, you don't sacrifice anyone else or anything else to try and extract value from it. For the first time, you're turning towards yourself and sacrificing yourself, meaning you're going to go beyond yourself. You're willing to go beyond how you understand your own nature right now. The outcome from that is always ideal. It never, ever interferes with anyone else, with anyone else's will. Never conflicts with it, ever. But if I play out a false understanding that I have of myself, let's say I like being angry and self-righteous, someone's going to be on the wrong end of that. through my eyes, it might seem like it's good, and that behaving that way, it promises me an outcome that I care about in the future. But if you pay attention and you look, and this is the point of spiritual practice, right? In Imagia, we have binding practice is one example of it. You'll see that what's promised never turns up. But what you do get is the destruction of the thing that you care about. Which is why many people can end up pursuing something, some kind of strategy, moral, political, whatever it might be. They pursue it, things just get worse, and they don't understand why. So they just double down on the same thing. But does it ever deliver the thing that it's promising? Jung calls this, well, rather the alchemists call this the mysterium conjunctionis. You are going to find the opposites together. If you pursue something, you'll find its opposite if you travel far enough. But if you're doing your true will, you're sacrificing yourself, going beyond yourself, union with the divine, right? Discovering your own nature, participating in the process of creation, and it's joyful. That's another message in the Book of the Law, it's joyful. And our sorrows are but as shadows, and they pass and they're done, but there's that which remains. When we're not doing our true will, all we are doing is being in conflict with other people and their will. That's all we're doing, we're just in conflict with everyone else. That is what our world looks like right now, and it's looked that way since the beginning of the 20th century. And it's why in the third chapter of the Book of the Law, we have the god of this world at this time, which is Ra-Horkuit, god of war and of vengeance. Now, here's a key idea in the book. It says, do your will, union with the divine, always to me, right? But if you don't do this, you can expect the direful judgments of Ra-Horkuit, the god of war and of vengeance. So it's very simple. It's very simple. You either have a connection with the divine, you're either seeking union with the divine, or you're in a world of war and of vengeance. And that's not pretty.
No. And that is really relevant to the times that we're living through, isn't it? I mean, like you were saying, people trying to attain a specific result, they just keep pursuing that doubling down. You know, we see that a lot, don't we?
Yeah, and it always means the sacrifice of others.
Yeah.
Extracting value from others, wishing people were other than they were. How well has that been working out for you, if you've been doing that, you know?
It leads to the war of all against all, doesn't it? The more people do that, the more people they come into conflict with.
Yeah, and again, coming back to that idea of divine law, we all have a choice whether we follow it or not. We're free to choose to do that. We're told what the consequences are, and we've seen them. And again, this is why Crowley was instructed to give the Book of the Law to people, but it's up to them whether they follow it or not. It's up to each person individually, personally, to have a relationship with the divine law. In the same way you'd have a relationship with the divine, it can only be done intimately and personally, can it?
Yeah.
Right. And that relationship is no one else's business. So, to sum up anyway, the conception of the divine as infinite space and the infinite stars thereof, that's what heaven looks like, that's what eternity looks like, that's what the divine looks like. There is a conception of this divinity in Magia. The practices of Magia demonstrate and provide a means of understanding how we honour the law that was brought by Crowley, therefore how you do your true will. And you don't need anything else other than the Book of the Law to understand that law. There is that curious thing of the people that are drawn to the Book of the Law and Crowley's work, even though they find parts of it off-putting, Crowley's character off-putting, there's all of the salacious stories about Crowley, you know, he's the wickedest man in the world and so on. They know they've found what they're looking for, though, and yet they don't understand it yet, so they're going to grapple with these ideas and try and figure out what it means. So what's interesting about that is that here's a demonstration of what the personal relationship means. It's not dependent upon your preferences. It's not dependent upon the false understandings that you have of yourself already. You've been drawn to something, you don't know why, but it's like a nature being drawn to itself. Now, the alchemists talked about mercury. It's that divine action of like being drawn to like a form of magnetism. So they're drawn to that work. Well, if you're drawn to the work in that way, if you're drawn to the divine in this way, without understanding, without comprehension, despite your preferences, but you know you found what you're looking for, then the idea of a gatekeeper or of making it accessible or something like that is fundamentally mistaken and has nothing to do with the process that we're describing. And therefore, the relationship that we should have instead with texts like this or with the divine law is one best understood with an agricultural analogy, which is it's like a seed that's been planted. And you don't know what the whole thing is yet or what fruit it's going to produce, but you need to tend it every day, seeking union with the divine, right? You need to tend it every day and let it bloom and flower in its own time and produce fruit in its own time. And comprehension will come. You know, understanding will come. That's the point, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, that's how it should be with a text, with any genuine text that's been brought by the divine. That's the relationship.
Yeah. So people can be drawn to something. They don't know why. It seems averse to their nature, perhaps. Mm. So you're going to get all sorts of people drawn to this thing, aren't you?
Yeah.
There's going to be no pattern to that at all.
Mm. It reminds me of a student who ended up working with me years ago. He's a good friend. He said when he first came across these videos that I did for Open Enlightenment. Mm. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember those.
When I was deluded enough to think we could have an open public conversation about enlightenment, it failed spectacularly.
Yeah.
But I did a series of videos, and he came across those videos, and he said he watched one of the videos. Now, he'd been into Zen and he was interested in enlightenment and so on, but like he watched one of the videos and he had a physical, visceral reaction to me talking, which was that he wanted to vomit. Yeah, he found me repugnant.
Mm.
Repulsive. I think that's the word he uses, repulsive. But despite that, eventually, you know, I got into contact and we ended up working together.
Mm.
But that's how it can be.
Yeah.
That's how it can be, yeah. A very important thing to keep in mind when it comes to understanding divine law is that the invitation is always open. It's not made available based on meeting certain criteria, right? It's something that's part of your own nature and it's something you can say yes to at any time. Right? Now, there is the case where it can get so covered over, this divine spark inside, through choices that we make in our lives, that a person can no longer make that choice in any meaningful sense, right? But leaving that particular case aside, it's always there.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you get that thing in other traditions, don't you, about, you know, the people drawn into the tradition can be the biggest sinners.
The way divine law works, the moment you turn away from sin, and in the Book of Law, sin is described as restriction.
Mm.
Right? Which restriction of what? Not just restriction of a person or your bodily autonomy, or your capacity to exercise your preferences. That's not what it means by restriction. It means restricting the expression of your divine nature. Anything that restricts you from doing that is sin. It means to miss the mark. That's what sin means. To get it wrong, to misunderstand.
Yeah.
The moment you decide not to do that anymore and cultivate this relationship with the divine, to seek union with the divine, everything promised by that divine law is now yours. So you can behave one way and you can expect these bad consequences. Conflict, war, vengeance, and so on. You can indulge that. It doesn't matter how long you've been doing that for. If you have a change of conscience, if you realise you're not getting what you were promised, that this isn't the way things should be, that maybe there's something more to reality than philosophical speculation about car parking spaces. Soon as you say yes to your inheritance, it's yours.
Yeah.
No divine inheritance, it's yours, right? Again, that's the nature of divine law. So,
yeah, but thinking about other people's reactions to that, that may infuriate and disgust people that that's possible. And I suppose what that brings in is what you were talking about earlier. If somebody's holding to a particular view, if they're not doing their will, then they're going to come into conflict with other people. And that's maybe what we're seeing there. It will be outrageous to some people that what you're saying is the case.
And that's the degree to which they fall from what a human being is capable of in terms of understanding, love, compassion, mercy, all the things people claim they care about. Don't you want the person who's been making a mistake to stop making it?
Yeah.
Right? And become more than what they were, right? Don't you want them, if you're a Thelemite, to exercise their true will, perhaps for the first time in their entire lives? Well, here's the thing, you see, because if you are exercising your true will, you wouldn't be outraged by what we're talking about.
No, no. It's understandable that people might be, but as you say...
Yeah, but that's petty and small, isn't it?
Yeah,
which has got nothing to do with anyone's true will. It's got nothing to do with the divine. Nothing at all to do with it. So with that in mind, this is exactly how the order of the AA operates. As soon as someone makes that decision, and it's not one determined by human beings, it's something organic that happens with each person that's an intimate and private affair.
Mm.
And it's profound. So what person can turn someone away when it's the will of the divine that it's time for them to experience union with that nature?
Mm.
Who would stand in the way of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. There have been people online actively trying to dissuade people from joining the order. There have been people online saying all kinds of crazy stuff. I've got one example that I wanted to share because it demonstrates something about where we find ourselves currently as a culture and therefore how we might understand divine law in relationship to the situation we find ourselves in.
Mm.
So I'm just going to read one particular tweet, one particular reaction. Well, it's two reactions, really. Now, these reactions that were online, that were on Twitter, they're going to be anonymized. The point of this isn't to indulge drama. It's just to show the condition of occult discourse and the reactions to the nature of the order and how we might understand it in terms of what we've been talking about with True Will.
Mm-hmm.
These reactions are simply for the book Magia existing. So they're not reactions to me saying something that could be taken a certain way or you know, some kind of drama that I've been involved in. It's merely just for existing. Here's the first reaction. Someone says, I'd like to get into his work, that's my work, right, and even reading the book Magia. Unfortunately, the part where they mention the men and women of Alabaster reclaiming the West is really suspicious to me. I'm hoping, too, that I'm reading it right and not reading too much into it. Now, this is then followed up by another tweet, unfortunately by someone who is a known author, a non-Thelemic author. I only mention that because it's illustrative of what's expected within that community or a certain part of that community, right? And this is their follow-up to this original tweet. They say, yeah, those right-wing pseudo-intellectuals just love going on about the whiteness of ancient Europe, as shown in those pure white classical marble statues. Which, of course, is total ahistorical nonsense, but is a racist dog whistle.
Mm.
Now, the first tweet, we have someone who says that they would like to get into my work, get to grips with Magia. Unfortunately, the idea of the men and women of Alabaster reclaiming the West, which is a very curious phrase, is really suspicious to me. All right. So, obviously, Magia is concerned with the Western tradition. People are happy to look at the rest of the garden and say all kinds of fruits and flowers might bloom in other parts of the garden, but not in this corner over here, the Western corner.
Mm.
There can't be anything growing there that's of any value in terms of wisdom, right? But that's exactly what Magia is. It's that tradition in Europe, in the West. But this first tweet is someone who's saying there may be something there that they're interested in. However, paranoia, a fear, is preventing them from even looking.
Mm.
It's preventing them from even looking because this seems suspicious. This could be some kind of sin might be committed by accident, right? And it's a very particular sin, isn't it? It's a sin of, I don't know, suddenly finding yourself to be a white supremacist or something.
Yeah.
Very, very strange. But there we have it. There's a, what states is this person in? To feel this way. Fear, shame, the shame that they might find themselves committing this sin and causing others harm through doing that, the shame of being accused of that, scapegoating, what they call normative pressure, right? They don't want to be someone who will be subject to that scapegoating if they accidentally make this mistake.
Yeah,
fear, shame, scapegoating. These are the emotional states present in that tweet, and it characterizes, doesn't it, the online culture of the occult, particularly on these social media platforms. The guy that follows up, right, this community leader, or I'm not sure what the right term might be, but a focal point in the community, you know, a known person, just throws these terms around: right-wing pseudo-intellectual, likes going on about the whiteness of ancient Europe as shown in these pure white classical marble statues. It's a racist dog whistle. So being generous, right, the principle of generosity, maybe he's just talking generally and he's not talking about me, But the implication is there, isn't it? Maybe I am this person. I'm a right-wing pseudo-intellectual. And the reason I'm talking about the men and women of Alabaster, right, is because the fact that their statues from the ancient world were made of white marble is a secret code, is a wink, isn't it? It's a racist dog whistle. The content is, again, I want to be charitable. This isn't a high intellect that's making this claim. This is a strange way of understanding right-wing politics. And these are the people in charge of this community, or they're how can we put it? A group of people moulded by fear, shame, scapegoating, led by people who are this intellectually challenged, can actually pose a problem. They're not in touch with the reality anymore, right? But the consequences of their actions certainly do land in the reality of people's lives, don't they? It doesn't matter what Magia says. It doesn't matter why the statues are made of alabaster. Not white marble, by the way, but that doesn't really matter. The point is that the fear and the shame and the scapegoating is already aimed in this direction. Yeah. Right? And there may be consequences to that. For me, personally, there could be consequences for students, people who join the order. You could be tarred with that brush, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Could be consequences for you, Dunk, doing this podcast with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be consequences for my family.
Right. Yeah.
In the first episode, we were decrying the fact that everyone seems so sensitive these days. Mm. That apparently there are all these people everywhere with objectionable opinions. We were saying it just wasn't like that 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
No.
And what was more important was sharing a cultural space with people you disagreed with.
Yeah, yeah.
But the objection to that is that the objectionable views don't affect you personally, and therefore you're privileged.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So looking at these comments that are made, and like I said before, these aren't the only ones, would we then say these are objectionable views? And therefore these people are privileged because it doesn't affect them? It obviously affects us, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it affects them too, doesn't it? Because there's, like you were saying, there's a real sense of fear, suspicion, paranoia there. You know, I mean, it's difficult to think that someone's going to become a white supremacist completely inadvertently. You know, that it's something that they're going to stumble into.
Well, what I see there, Dunk, is I don't see people who are privileged, even though they have these delusional opinions divorced from reality, right, that could actually pose a danger to me and other people that I care about, have consequences, real life consequences.
Mm.
Right, I don't see people who are privileged. I see people who are drowning. Fear, shame, scapegoating, and that's what they're drowning in. And do you know what you should do if you see someone drowning?
Certainly not jump in. I think that's the general advice, isn't it? Because they will pull you under.
Yeah, you'll drown too. If you come across someone acting from those states, fear, shame, scapegoating, they'll say these extraordinary things, extraordinary accusations, and your immediate response will be to fall into those states. Because it's a horrible thing to say to someone, isn't it, that they're a racist? So what's the first move you make as any reasonable person is to deny it. The problem there is that you've got in the water with them. Fear, shame, scapegoating. Fear that these people are going to come after you, that they're saying these things about you. The shame that people might think this of you even though it's not true. The fact that you'll be scapegoated, there'll be consequences as a result of people thinking these things about you. And it doesn't even matter whether they're true or not.
Mm-hmm.
So when people make statements like this, when you see an online community that operates like this, this is a group of people who are drowning. And if you don't want to drown, instead of engaging with it, instead of dealing with them, you should look for higher ground.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a deluge, if there's a flood, what you want to do is instead of trying to swim in it or to try and save people who are drowning, who are just going to drown you, is turn around and look for higher ground.
Yeah.
Do you know what higher ground is in this case?
Doing your true will.
Yeah. Because this is where we find ourselves culturally now. Repeating waves of this deluge of the fear and shame and scapegoating, right? We've seen waves of it. Some people are swept up in it. Some of those people will drown when the next big wave comes and they won't be coming back again. Right? Every time it happens, it gets worse. Some people may have experienced being swept along by a wave, right? But then they come to their senses and then they decide to pull themselves out. Now, this is the choice we're faced with culturally, and this is where we're at when it comes to not just magical culture, right, but in all walks of life. You're either going to be seeking union with the divine, having a connection with the divine, seeking higher ground, or you're prone to drowning. You'll fall into the herd, this drowning herd of people, where fear and shame and scapegoating, totally divorced from reality, will consume that group of people, will consume them. So one thing I wanted to say, and I wanted to make clear, is that if you're tired of drowning, if you're tired of it and want to get out of the water, the order or the teaching, right, is happy to extend a hand for you to hold on to pull yourself out. It doesn't matter what anyone said about the teaching or about me, stuff that they might have said online, if they were just going along with things, or even if they believed it at the time. But if they've changed their minds, if they're tired of drowning and they want to save themselves, then the order would be lucky to have them.
Yeah. But maybe important to point out that all the order is there for, I presume, is for people to do their true will, isn't it? Yeah. And doing your true will, I think it's important to point out, doesn't have any bearing on outcomes. When those waves come, doing your true will doesn't mean that things are going to work out nicely for you, that times aren't going to be challenging and troubling, but it will mean that you're not drowning.
Yeah, and just as those people that are drowning and are prone to drowning will drag everyone down with them that they can, right? Eventually, they will destroy themselves. But those people that are doing their true will, and that can be expressed in many different ways in different traditions, but those people, they discover each other. They'll discover each other. Not only that, but as a result of the drowning herd and the events that unfold as a result of that, those virtuous characteristics that they exercise in the world as a result of doing their true will, right, are cultivated further, and they support each other as a group as a result of that. So it's a movement in two different directions. And the, you know, this branch of the Arcanum Arcanorum is one example of that in the world. Yeah. So shall I stop recording, or is there anything else to say?
Well, we need to wrap up with something trite, don't we?
Okay. I feel like I've talked a lot, so do you want to say something trite?